is the world's most populous country heading for a demographic crisis? China's population has shrunk for the first time in 61 years. What's behind the downturn? And what will it take to reverse the trend? This is Inside Story. Welcome to the programme. I'm Sahil Rahman, and this is Inside Story from Doha. China's population has shrunk for the first time in 60 years. Official data shows the birth rate slowed to 6.77 babies per 1,000 people in 2022. Compounding the issue is that deaths outnumbered births last year. Economists warn the low birth rate and rapidly aging population will have far-reaching effects, and not just locally, but on the global economy. Katrina Yu begins our coverage from Shanghu County in northern China.
Zhao Chunming has lived in Baijiawan village his whole life. He says the streets here are quieter than they used to be. Most young people have moved to Beijing, 65 kilometers away.
There are more and more old people now, too many old people in this village. Although five passed away recently due to the COVID, they were over 80 years old.
The situation is similar in many parts of China, where increasingly deaths are outstripping births. The population shrunk by 850,000 people in 2022. It's the first decline since 1961, a year of great famine in China. Economists say strict coronavirus measures, imposed until late last year, accelerated a looming demographic crisis.
The pandemic has been the biggest constraint for people's family planning in the past 3 years. And a lot of Chinese people believe that the vaccination would be bad for fertility. So many families have been postponing. And when it comes to the economic pressure, it was an even bigger problem for urban residents.
The government abandoned its one-child policy in 2016 and now allows families to have up to three children. But many are unwilling, citing soaring housing prices and education fees. Meanwhile, China's workforce, a key driver of economic growth, is rapidly aging. Analysts predict the elderly will make up one-third of the population by 2050. In Baijiawan, most of the residents are retired.
The cost of living in villages like this is far less than the bigger cities. But locals tell us the problem is being able to find a stable income. Many of the young people who were born here have been forced to leave in order to secure a job.
Zhao Chunming says he understands. He and his wife have no children, but still struggle to make ends meet. For many here, living day to day, having to support a large family has little appeal.
Well, for years, China's population has been shaped by birth control regulations. In 1979, in an effort to slow population growth, Beijing implemented a one-child policy. It was strictly enforced with fines, punishment such as loss of employment and forced abortions. The result was gender imbalance, as traditionally male children are preferred over female to carry on the family name. Baby girls were dumped, placed in orphanages or even killed at birth. The policy was revised in 2016, but couples hesitated, citing the high costs of property, childcare, healthcare and education. The 2020 census highlighted a looming demographic crisis. It prompted another revision, this time up to three children. Let's bring in our guest for this edition of Inside Story in Beijing is Aina Tangen, Senior Fellow at the Tahi Institute. In Bristol is Winnie King, a senior lecturer in Chinese international political economy at Bristol University. And in Saint-Gallen in Switzerland is Guido Cosi, a professor of macroeconomics at Saint-Gallen University. Welcome to you all on this edition of Inside Story. Aina, can I come to you in Beijing first? I mean, this is generally a story that seems to resonate with a lot of countries at the moment globally. And this sort of demographic change has become quite a topic of conversation. Why should the authorities or public in China be worried about a shrinking population when there are over a billion in terms of the population, all sort of clamouring for the same resources and services from the government?
Well, it has a lot to do with, you know, workers and smoothing out the line. If you looked at China's population over the last 70, 80 years, you'll see, you know, there are periods when there was a lot of births and then periods when there were very few, especially during this one child period. And that was a deliberate policy by the government to bring down the population. But now they put it into reverse. They want to make sure that not that they have lots and lots more people, but that they have the number of people that they need in order to run their economy. They are very much concentrated on this idea of expenditure driven and things like that. But it also has to do with infrastructure. Imagine trying to build cities and thinking to yourself, you know, I don't know how many, we're going to have less people in the future, but people have needs now. So it's all about putting the pieces together.
Okay, Winnie, can I come to you in Bristol? Obviously, an expert in the Chinese economy, but would you agree with what Aina's just said? Because it is actually a conversation that is happening globally in different countries at different levels through different cultures as well.
Yes, that's for sure. I mean, not just with regards to developed worlds, but in this case for China, developing world. I think picking up on his point about infrastructure, a key point is also due to the fact that because China has traditionally relied upon its population and its family and community networks with regards to support, with regards to childcare, healthcare, care for pensioners and elderly, there's a significant kind of policy and infrastructure deficit within China itself that the government is trying to build up in order to help take care of its aging economy. And if you're going to have a population that you're trying to encourage to have children after decades of a shift in policy, then you obviously need to make up for a deficit in that area as well, because you don't have the kind of childcare provisions that are necessary. So in terms of party legitimacy, this is a very key thing, not just with regards to ensuring the economic engine continues, but with regards to ensuring that the population itself is supported.
Let's go to Switzerland and Guido Cosi there in Saint-Gallen. I mean, you've heard what our speakers have said. I mean, how concerned will the government be at these statistics in Beijing? Because they've made the statistics public, and analysts like yourself and others globally with a range of social and economic experience will look at perhaps what reforms the Chinese Communist Party has to make, because it has to make some serious decisions in the next few years.
Yes, and what is difficult is to change a trend that is predetermined from the past, because even if we increase, if they increase childcare and put in place any policy to possible to stimulate birth rates, still it will take some time, for minimum 20 years or so until these people can work. Meanwhile, if you look at the Chinese population pyramid, we will see that the most hefty group is the group in their 50s, so from 50 to 59, who were born just before 1980 and the single child policy. In 20 years' time, or even less, these people will be unable to work, and they will bear on the pensions. So the young will have to support them, and this is going to be a very daunting task.
Indeed, Aina, can I just come back to you in Beijing? Because, you know, with focusing on young people, one has to look back at history. And as you've said, you know, one of the big issues in the 60s was this one-child policy. I mean, it was a policy conducted and executed at a time in history that the Chinese Communist Party thought was the right decision. In retrospect, was it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, China, you can't imagine China with a burgeoning population, with every family having, you know, six or, you know, eight kids, as was traditional. Obviously, infant mortality was an issue back then. But with modern medicine, imagine, we would be blowing past 2 billion people, the amount of resources out there. I really, you know, while this is definitely about how China is reacting to this, let's look at this in a modern context. The fact is that, you know, in the U.S., agriculture, produces more food than the U.S. citizens can actually consume, with less than 2% of the population. China has 32% of its people in the rural areas. Automation is changing the way factories work. There are less and less line workers, more and more people who are repairing the machines that are actually doing it. So I don't necessarily know that there's a correlation between, you know, this classical economic model that you need more people in order to grow. I think really, as we enter a tertiary economy, it's really about having disposable income. And that means a greater and larger middle class, not necessarily just simply more people. Okay. Look at India, look at Africa. They have plenty of young people, but plenty of problems because they don't have jobs.
Mm. I mean, Winnie King in Bristol, can I just bring you in there? Because, of course, 2016 saw the policy scrapped to allow two children. Then last May, the policy was revised for three children. I mean, you can't demand or expect people to produce children on the get-go, can you? It's a very difficult sort of scenario to be in if you're in a society where you weren't allowed to have more than one child for a long time. Then all of a sudden the state says, oh, you can have a few more.
Yeah, that is very true. I mean, you're talking about a mindset that you're changing, that of a policy that's been in place for well over three, four decades. The thing that we really need to take into account, however, is that there's a different kind of context that the Chinese population is facing. It's not just the fact that if we look from the 1980s until 2020, the population in China grew from 660 million to 1.4 billion. And I think the previous speaker is absolutely correct, is that it does take time. Absolutely does take time. But there are other policy initiatives that the government can take into account if we're talking just about trying to bolster the economy. And that includes allowing for immigration. China's foreign population in terms of foreign residents is very, very small compared to the population. It's the native population itself. And so if we're talking about scope for feeding into the young workforce and the innovative workforce, there's definitely means to do that. With regards to innovation, it's about how you use the resources you have more efficiently. Innovation, focusing on healthcare, focusing on technology, the Internet of Things are all policies and strategies that the Chinese government is trying to adopt as a means to diversify its economy away from the traditional kind of made in China, export-oriented manufacturing economy that we're used to. So there's potentially more breathing space for China's growing middle class or its youth to try and choose what kind of job or career that they want to have that's far more innovative, is higher paid, and therefore provides for a larger and better tax base.
So, Guido, can I just bring you in here in Saint-Gilles? Because obviously, you know, you've got the urban mindset and you've got the rural mindset. I'm going to get Ina in on this as well in a moment, because, of course, they're very different mindsets culturally as well. And that if you say you can have more than one child, the urban mindset is to have more children, maybe to look after the farm or to look after the community, but they might not necessarily get the education and the level of education that Winnie's talking about to actually help the Chinese economy in the future when it comes to technology or development. I mean, how do you regard this sort of rather interesting equation at the moment that the Chinese Communist Party will have to think about?
Absolutely. As the country grows, the fertility transition inevitably takes place. So, and this happened everywhere. And we know, of course, it happened before in Europe, but then it's happening everywhere in the rest of the world. So there is a transition from quantity to quality of children. So do you want to have many unskilled, uneducated children, or few, or even one or two well-educated children? And of course, families decide for this as the country grows, and education compensates for quantity because it allows innovation and better use of innovation. It was mentioned also robotics, artificial intelligence. These are aspects in which China is already a champion, and it has to invest a lot on it. The silver lining of having a more mature population, let's say, compared to India, if we compare the two, 50% of the population in India is below the age of 29. 39 would be the number for for China. So having more mature people means having more educated people. Of course, if India manages to well educate its young population, they may reach China even technologically and even overtake it, because their knowledge would be more new, you know, less obsolete. So there are tensions, there are opportunities, but certainly innovation will be the major challenge, and it has to to be at the center. You know, it has to be indigenous innovation, not just importing knowledge from the rest of the world, which would, by the way, exacerbate trade disputes, for example, on intellectual property rights.
Sure. Both Aina and Winnie were agreeing with you. Aina, can I just come in to you? You were nodding in agreement.
Yes. I mean, first off, let's not take this too far out of context. Remember, we're coming out of an extraordinary period of COVID. During that, there were a lot of social changes. There are a lot fewer marriages, obviously. There are a lot fewer children being born. There's a lot more uncertainty. People were isolating, you know, physically. So, you know, the ability to find a mate and have children, or the time to have a children, given that hospitals were full or potentially dangerous, people did hold back. Also, there are, you know, certain things culturally within China. They like the year of the tiger generally and things like that. But I guess that didn't make as big a difference as we thought. In any event, put it into context. It is a quality versus quantity issue, and it has to do with the ability of these young people to earn money so that they can, in fact, support not only their elders, but through taxes, support the entire social service system. So I agree with my colleagues that this is not something simply like there. 8 billion people are putting a lot of pressure on the world's resources. Adding more to it irresponsibly would not help.
So, Winnie, let me bring you in here, because we talked about how maybe the state is saying what it wants to do, and yet, as Aina just mentioned, you know, society has changed, and so has technology. Over the past 20 years. We're living in a time of social media, the internet, the potential to travel, seeing and experiencing the world where previous generations lived in a very isolated, closed society that China could be described as. Does the state's requirement for manpower resonate, do you think, with the younger generation who aspire, perhaps, to want the things that other young people around the world want? They want to travel, they want to see the world, they want to have savings and buy a house. Whereas if there are more children in the family, they might not get those opportunities.
I mean, Chinese people are like any other people. It's human nature to be curious and want to move up the social ladder or to experience things that others experience. That's without a doubt. I think one way that I think we have that's problematic in looking at it is that we see the Chinese youth or the Chinese young labor force as in a bubble, that they're located in China and that's where they'll stay. And in actual fact, they're very, very mobile. They're very well educated, they're very mobile, and they are very ambitious. And I think the very fact that the Chinese economy is no longer just restricted to its domestic borders, but is actually through its Belt and Road Initiative, a strategy to try and promote and invest and collaborate with other economies internationally, not just developing economies in the global south, but also in Western economies and developed economies, that there's scope for these graduates and these the Chinese labor force to expand their, not just expand their footprint internationally, but also to bring that back to China domestically, to try and promote domestic development in a rather in tandem, to find a balanced way. So I think there's a way to contribute to that in the domestic economy as they try and go abroad and experience all the experiences that any young person would want to experience.
Aina, can I just come back to you? Because, you know, looking at social media as well, coming out of China about, you know, debates over the having the child policy, whether it's one, two or three, comments have from people, things like, you know, I don't want kids. I have a problem in my own workplace dilemma. Why would I want to bring children into a world like this? You know, some women talking of no children until they've had higher education opportunities and career progression. And others talk about, you know, longer working hours and overtime. And do you really want to be in that sort of scenario? Genuine concerns and worries about the workplace and about bringing young people into a world that's revolving around, you know, manufacture or industry?
Well, yeah, no, there's definitely a lot of higher expectations. But, you know, let me tell you, when I first came to China, I met a man by the side of a road whose house was about 3 feet from the road, and he was beaming. He told me he was happy the road was there because he could get his produce to market. And he had chicken once a week instead of once a year. You know, China's come a long way, but it's become very middle class very, very quickly, as my colleagues agree. And as a result, there is a different sense of these things. Now, I talk to people all the time. I ask them, you know, younger people. I have younger children in that 28 to 30 year range. And, you know, they would say, well, you know, how many children do we actually want? They're concerned about the environment, the impact that people have. They have very, very different things. And we're not talking just about China. Sure. This phenomenon goes across the Western world. So it's, you know, it's something that's not. But one, okay, go ahead.
Let me just bring in Winnie here, because I just quickly want to bring in another angle to this, because China talks about wanting to be, you know, captain on the water, its maritime strength, it wants to explore space. Not everyone that is produced in China will be able to have that brain power or that education to be part of that scientific or military group. Do you think there is a possibility, you touched on it just a moment ago, about whether China may have to look beyond its borders to bring the talent in? Would it look to foreign workers to bring advancement to the country? Is it something it has to consider?
Well, it's already begun doing that. So with regards to its high-tech, technologically based strategies, it's adopted specific policies to allow for easier visa pathways, for residency requirements, to encourage foreign workers of specific industries, high-skilled, highly educated, highly experienced, to come to China to basically feed into the industries that the Chinese government and the Communist Party are particularly interested in developing in China. So it's not a new thing. And it's at present, I think it's relatively untapped, because it's not just about bringing people into China, but it's also about sending about its own citizens going abroad and then returning back to China to influence their own development, which is something that's happened in the past. But at the high tech level, it's quite new.
And of course, Guido, if I can just bring you in here, I mean, China's not the only country in the region thinking the same way. You've got the ASEAN countries, you've got India, which you touched upon, that, you know, has a lot of its young graduates go abroad and come back to help within, you might say, the domestic economy. I mean, China is looking over its shoulder, isn't it, to its very stronger and becoming stronger neighbours?
Yes, clearly India is more integrated with the Western world, China a little bit less. So foreign policy matters, geopolitics matters. So we all hope that in a weightless economy where, as it was mentioned, social media, digitization, ideas matter, and this is super important for innovation, ideas can be shared better, of course, respecting the rewards for innovation. However, ideas shall circulate better. I was surprised in this period, in this vaccination race, to see China failing to import the modern technology about vaccines. In fact, they relied on inactivated virus vaccines, which are more dangerous and less effective than, say, mRNA or even the techniques used by Oxford AstraZeneca. So I think there is a lot more knowledge sharing to be accomplished to overcome the challenges of population aging, and as was said, not just in China, also in the Western world. So because ideas can be infinitely replicated in production, so it is important to find the right way to share them.
And there we have to leave it, because obviously the debate about COVID and China is a different story for a very different day. But for now, we have come to the end of this particular edition of Inside Story. I'd like to thank all of my guests, Anna Tangen in Beijing, Winnie King in Bristol, and Guido Cose in Saint-Gallen, Switzerland. Thank you very much. And thank you for watching as well. You can see the programme again anytime by visiting our website at aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJ Inside Story. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle there is @AJ Inside Story. From Issa Hill-Rahman and all of the Inside Story team here in Doha, thanks for your time and your company.